This episode of Pub Talk Live was recorded on October 26, 2019, with guest co-host Kelly Garrett and special guest Amanda Nelson. Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in today. Welcome to the October 26th episode of Pub Talk Live, the live publishing talk show airing the second and fourth Saturday of every month at 9 p.m. Eastern. I'm your host, Sarah Nicholas. I'm a young adult author, the current managing director of Pitch Wars, and a library event planner. Just a couple announcements before we get started. We have some great guests for you today. You can subscribe to reminders via email by clicking in the link in the description so that you don't miss a show. And you can also follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at Pub Talk Live, all one word, no special characters. And if you'd like to support the show, you can find a link to the Patreon near the end of the video description down below again. So I am going to introduce today's guest co-host, Kelly Garrett. Kelly Garrett's first novel, Hollywood Homicide, about a semi-famous mega broke Black actress, won the Agatha, Anthony, Lefty, and Ippy Awards for Best First Novel. It's also one of BookBub's top 100 crime novels of all time. The second, Hollywood Ending, was featured on the Today Show's Best Summer Reads of 2019, was nominated for both Anthony and Lefty Awards. Prior to writing books, Kelly spent 8 years working in Hollywood, including a stint writing for Cold Case. She now works for a leading media company and serves on the board of directors for Sisters in Crime. So, everyone, welcome Kelly to the show.
There, hi. Hi.
Hello.
Sneak peek. We had a little sneak peek.
Yeah.
Hi, guys.
Yeah, it's fine. all right. So, I'm going to check the comments. Heather says hi. Hey, Heather. Alex Segura.
Hi, Alex.
Alex was messaging us before. Holly says hi. Jennifer Morris, she says hello. Hey, Jennifer. Ebony says hi.
Ebony's she's a faithful watcher, right? I've seen her name a lot.
Yeah, Ebony also says, I loved Cold
Case. Oh, yay.
I did too. I remember watching it late at night. Like when I was in college. Yeah. Jennifer.
I still get residual checks. It's been 10 years and I still get checks off that show, which is nice.
Well, because it's on like Ion Television or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, it's on.
Right?
It airs a lot. It airs a lot of places. So.
All right. So I'm going to send everyone over to our viewer poll if you haven't already voted in it today. The question is, where do you most often find out about books that you would like to read? And obviously, Twitter doesn't let you do like multi-select, so you do have to choose one, unfortunately. But this is just like a non-scientific poll, so it's fine. And I'm going to post the link to that in the comments, so you can go check that out. And we're just going to like dive right in. You ready, Kelly?
I'm ready. Hi, Jennifer. I just saw it. She said hi to me.
All right. So we have two updates on two legal cases that we discussed in the last episode. So I just wanted to give quick updates on those. An update on the Audible caption story. Audible has made a proposal to the plaintiffs that it believes will, quote, moot the lawsuit. So this is not a settlement. They're making a proposal that they think will basically make the plaintiffs drop the case. And the publishers are considering the proposal, so Audible has requested a one-week suspension and says it will update the court by this Wednesday. But there is no info about what the proposal entails. So I guess we'll find out soon.
We have a week or Wednesday. We'll find out Wednesday.
Yeah, half a week. Unless they say no, of course, and then you never know. And the update on the CASE Act from last episode, so as a refresher, that's an act that's going to just make it easier for people to sue for copyright infringement. And the bill has passed the House and it's moving on to the Senate now. And it has bipartisan support, like it was however many to 4 is how it passed the House. So, yeah, we'll see what happens there. And okay, so the first new thing is, I don't have a link for this. By the way, all the news items, I'm going to post links later after the episode ends so everyone can read more about what we're talking about. So last week I put them in the comments, but let me know if you would prefer to put them in the comments or put them in the description, which would be better for y'all. Feel free to like comment that. Because I know YouTube does funny things with the comments where it like hides some of them unless you click. All right. So the first thing I wanted to talk about today is it was a message from or a tweet from Elena Roth Parker, who is a literary agent. She is a literary agent for Kara Cass. And she tweeted that someone was impersonating their rights manager and emailing the co-agents, foreign publishers, and scouts to get their hands on Kara Cass's new manuscript.
That's a lot of work.
Yeah.
It's like a lot of work.
The email looks like it's from her, but the reply address goes somewhere else. So this person has created an email address and then put like the rights manager as the from person. I can see Amanda's face. She's going to be on later. And Amanda's like, whoa. So that's, yes. Everyone's like, that's crazy. Yeah. It's something. That's for sure. But then she followed up by saying, our foreign publisher has told us that this is happening more and more on the bigger international authors. So this isn't like a single incident. This is like something that people are doing.
Do you think they're trying to like get it so they can put it online and, you know, like, or do you think they want to read it? Like, what do you think is going on?
Both? I don't know. Like, it could be either.
That's a lot of work just to want to read a book early. And yeah. I get it because I want to read a lot of books early, but I'm not going to like be making up fake email addresses and trying to find like people's email addresses. That's a lot of work.
Yeah, I don't.
That's a big fan, if that's a fan.
Yeah, I don't know if I like anyone that much.
No, I don't. Not even myself. I wouldn't even email my own agent to get anything.
Oh, man. That's happening. So if whoever's doing it is watching the show, feel free to tell us why.
Stop it. Also stop doing it.
Yeah, that's what Elena said in her email or in her tweet. Stop it. All right. So Kelly, you have some more sobering news.
So I'm going to say the name wrong. It's Intira Bang, right? Is that right?
Okay. I think so.
Intira Bang Books in Dallas, they suffered major damage due to a direct hit from a tornado that swept through last Sunday, and the roof was ripped off. And when you guys see the pictures, when Sarah posts the link, like it's just amazing to see the damage. And it's interesting, but the books seem like they're okay, but they did have to cancel several events and probably won't be able to reopen at that same location. So that's really, sorry to hear that. And so I was kind of saying also that I recently sent two books to a library that had damage from the California wildfires last year. So they lost all of their books in fires. And so they ended up getting a grant to get 1,200 books. And they had a bunch of authors send stuff like that. So I don't think we ever really think about that. Like when things happen, what happens to places where people gather, you know, and are able to use them to kind of interact with people. So,
yeah. They've had to cancel some events and they're like looking for the events are like a little further away, but they did lose inventory for the event last week. Yeah.
Too bad.
And so this is their website. We put it here because they are taking online orders. They did ask that you be patient with shipping times. So if you want to help them out and you have some books you want to buy, you may want to buy them from bookstores because we got to support our indie bookstores, right?
Yeah, definitely.
All right. So I just want to go back. Jennifer said something about the first thing. They'll have plenty of time in jail for reading, or so I've heard.
Hopefully get books.
I guess impersonating a person is technically illegal, right? I don't know if they'll ever get charged for it, though.
But also piracy is illegal, so.
Yeah, if that's what they're going to do with it. All right. So Balker just published a report, and in 2018, they saw 40% more books self-published in the U.S. than in 2017. And so there were 1.68 million prints and ebooks self-published last year. And in 2013, that number was just 460,000, which means that the self-published books with ISBNs have increased 263% from 2013 to 2018. And this is just a survey by Bowker, which only measures based on ISBNs registered. So it doesn't include any ebooks self-published on Amazon without an ISBN. So I think that number is probably much, much higher because I feel like a lot of people just do Amazon. And I was at a writer's conference this week, and I actually mentioned this because I think a lot of authors who are looking to self-publish don't realize the extent of their competition. And even just as, you know, in traditional published authors, like all these email box book or all these ebooks out there, it's a lot. It's a lot.
It's a lot of choices. Yeah, you know, people still are emailing foreign rights agents for books that aren't out yet. So many choices.
There are 1.8 million books published this year, but someone still needs to email
the one that's not.
So Jennifer asked, are these published books or just ISBNs? So these are ISBNs that are registered as published books. So they're ISBNs that have been bought and then assigned to a book. Yeah.
All right, so PEN America, which is a nonprofit that works to defend and celebrate free expression through the advancement of literature and human rights, has opened 6 regional chapters. So they're headquartered in New York, and they have an office in LA already, but now they're going to have offices in Austin, Texas, Birmingham, Dallas, North Carolina, Detroit, and Tulsa. And so the CEO, Suzanne Nozzle, said that they are, quote, pushing back against the marginalization of vital voices and encroachment on press freedom, end quote. And so each new chapter will host writers and conversations, advocacy campaigns, public debates, and other expression and writing-related events. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think it's especially cool because I've been following PEN America, like, on social media for a while. Mm-hmm. And I always felt like it was kind of like, I don't like impenetrable, like it was hard to really kind of get involved with anything they're doing. Yeah. And so I think this will open those doors quite a bit more.
Especially because everything's always in New York. So it's nice that they're expanding beyond that. So,
yeah. Tulsa is an interesting choice. I lived in Tulsa once, so I can say that.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll leave it at that. We'll leave it at that one.
Yeah. So the educational division, I never know how to say this publisher's name, by the way.
I looked it up. Oh, okay. It's Houghton. Houghton. Yes.
Miffle.
Like Houghton. Yes. That's how I remembered it.
Houghton Miffle. HMH announced it will slash its workforce by 8%, which is about 288 jobs. They said a, quote, redesigned developmental model will result in 20% less, quote, content developmental expenditures than previously. Those are
fancy words.
Yeah, some big words that I don't know what that means. Like, are they going to be reusing content? Are they going to be maybe hiring freelancers that they pay less than full-time people? But that is just the educational division. So that's okay. Not, you know, like fiction. Yeah.
It's too bad to hear though.
It's, you know, people, we're often talking about like the challenges of publishing faces. And, it's always sad to hear when a big book publisher like lays off people.
Oh, definitely. So there's actually some other HMH news as well. So they just announced that they won't be releasing Outrages, which is the latest nonfiction book by a best-selling author, Naomi Wolf, that's about gay people in Victorian England. So in case you forgot, Outrageous was actually released in the UK in May. And so during an interview with the BBC, Wolf was questioned about whether she'd wrongly interpreted that some gay people had received the death penalty for their sexual orientation. So Houghton originally had planned to release it, but then they changed their mind. I think they said something like, oh, new questions have arisen. And so she, of course, felt like the issues could be fixed and she still wanted the book released. And so I think to me, the interesting thing about this is how publishers don't fact check their books to ensure they're accurate. You know, they say it's, I guess, too expensive to do. You know, I come from a journalism background and where you fact check everything. And so, and also when I like read a book, I assume like it's accurate, or, you know, like a nonfiction book, it's accurate because it's a published book, you know? And so the New York Times actually did an article last month about how, about this case and other cases where kind of like them not having fact checkers have kind of come back to bite them a lot this year. So.
Yeah, I remember first hearing about this, and she so like on the sentences it said, "Oh my gosh, what was the word?"
So yeah, some kind of phrase or wording that was that she misinterpreted.
Yeah, it sounds like a normal person, like to a normal person, that they were killed, but it's just like a common like legal phrase, I can't remember what the word was, but it's like obviously she should have like. Done a little research on what that word meant.
Fact checking, yeah.
Yeah. So Kendra said, finally, can't believe it took them so long to cancel Naomi Wolf. So I saw someone, I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was like one of those little things. It's like, you know, the beer before liquor rhymes or whatever, but it was like how to tell the difference between Naomi Wolf and Naomi Klein. And I remember what it was, but it was like, Naomi Klein, you're fine. Naomi Wolf. It was like, watch out, oof, or something. I don't know. It would just like crack me up so much. And Jennifer said, I would assume the editor would be the fact checker for a book. Author, obviously the author would be doing it that first, but actually nonfiction book publishers have actual like fact checkers where that is their job, is to confirm facts. Separate from the editor. Well, some nonfiction.
They
use them selectively. But also, I just read about this literally like while I was getting ready for the show, so it's not on our show notes or anything. But there are two books announced this week, big books that are political books. But the reason why I think they're notable is they're being published very quickly. So one of them is by the anonymous writer who wrote that I am part of the resistance inside the Trump administration, the New York Times article. So they got him to publish a book, and it was announced this week and is being released November 19th.
Well, do you think that maybe they were working on it for a while and they just
announced
it?
Maybe.
I hope. They didn't write it within like a month. That's hard.
But then this one, HMH again. Hey. Like the star of today's show, announced a title from Neil Katyal. I don't know how to say his last name. He's a former acting solicitor general about impeach. It's called Impeach, the case against Donald Trump, and it's being released November 26th. So that is a quick turnaround.
Are the Iowa, like, why are they doing it both in November? I wonder if it's like a political thing.
I think they're just trying to get it out while everyone's talking about it. Mm. Which I just think it's like, so with this Naomi Wolf book, they've had so long, you know, to fact check it and cancel it. And then they're like shoving these books out the door.
Yeah, sure. They're not fact checked as well. Maybe they will be. I don't know. They're like calling, they're tweeting at Donald Trump, asking him to confirm.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. So here's something that I just saw a couple days ago in New York Times. Let's see. Okay. Patricia Highsmith's Literary Estate is going to be publishing a 650-page book drawn from 8,000 pages of her diaries. But what's weird about this is what draws the eye is like she was kind of famously secretive and the diaries were hidden behind sheets and towels in her home. And her longtime editor has said it will include entries on her romantic relationships, her struggle with her sexuality, and musings on her fascination with violence. But also she's like, she said some pretty racist and anti-Semitic things, you know. And her editor had said that she won't censor those thoughts, which I was like, when I heard this, I was like, I wonder if they're going to cut that out. And apparently they're not. But what's really surprising, though, and like this was at the end of the article, which I feel like it should have been at the beginning. She mentioned the journals in her will and left instructions to edit out repetition. That was what she was
concerned just repetition. That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. Only problem.
Yeah. That's the only thing she doesn't want people to see.
Don't think bad of her.
But so like this whole article was a ride. Cause I was like, really? They're publishing her journals. Cause she's like secretive. And then, the racist statements and then no, she said it was fine. Like, I don't, what? that was really
So not as exciting, but also kind of exciting or interesting at least. So Macmillan is about to start an ebook embargo for libraries, and they're only allowing them to purchase one ebook copy of each new release in the first 2 months after it comes out. And then after 2 months, they can buy more copies, but at a higher price. And so King County Library System, and Washington has responded to the policy by saying that they will not buy any Macmillan ebooks for their 50 branches. And so this is really notable because they are the highest circulating digital library in the country. So even though they're not buying more ebooks or any ebooks from them, they will actually continue to buy the print books, and they might end up buying more print books to meet the demand of not having the ebooks. And then
which, by the way, is like exactly what Macmillan wanted from this embargo. So
it worked out. It worked out well. And then actually the Seattle Public Library has a different approach, and they will buy one electronic copy at the end of the 2 months. So there's not an inflated wait list at the end of the 2 month period. And then they may buy more copies if they see a need. And so this has been in the news a lot. And so the American Library Association actually wrote a report for the House Judiciary Committee's antitrust subcommittee about, quote, the unfair behavior by digital market actors, end quote, including Amazon and other publishers. And so ebooks and audiobooks that are produced by Amazon are actually not available to libraries at any price, which is really interesting. And the other thing I thought was really interesting is that libraries pay like $60 for access to, you obviously knew that, Sarah, for access to ebooks. And like, I'm like, I don't even want to pay like $5.99. So I can't even imagine.
Yeah. Every publisher kind of has like different terms. And so there's like there's all these different terms that you'll hear like librarians are around when they're talking about ebooks, but like one copy, one user, which feels obvious to me. But then they'll have, some of them will have limitations on how many times it can be checked out before basically their rights expire. Because they're using print books as an analogy, right? So like a print book can only be checked out so many times before it will fall apart and it has to be replaced.
Interesting.
But yeah, so Jennifer said that sucks for people who rely on libraries for their ebook reading. And that's what ALA's like major argument was. Well, I mean, among other things, but is that libraries for a long time have provided the access to people, and now, you know, they're not going to let libraries have these copies. Kendra said, "You're killing them, Macmillan. I'm already 20 people deep on my library holds." I just don't see how this is going to increase their sales, and that's why the Seattle
library. Me.
Yeah. That's why the Seattle Library isn't even going to buy that one copy until the end of the 2 months, because what happens if they have a popular book is the holds list will get like really long. And Seattle Public Library actually has a policy on how long their hold list will go before they buy a new book. And so that was a comment about artificially inflating the length of the list, is they didn't want, while they're able to only have one copy, for that list to get up to like 100 people. I prefer print, but so many people need electronic for large print or other issues. Ebooks have been a revolution for disabled readers.
It's just easier to get too, like, you know, I just go online and can get it within like, if I want to read a book, I go onto like the New York Public Library system, I look for it, if it's there, I can check it out and be reading it in 10 minutes versus having to get in my car, leave work to go to the library. So
yeah, you know, my library delivers print books.
Oh
yeah, to everyone.
That's nice.
Yeah, some libraries will do it for like homebound customers. But yeah, my library does it for everyone, which is always a surprise every time people move here.
Should check to see if your public library probably does not do that.
I don't think very many do, but
you know.
So it was announced last week that Drew Barrymore is going to produce two middle grade book adaptations, Howard Wallace P.I. by Casey Lyle and The Lost Girl by Anne Ursu. The first will be a half-hour comedy. The second will be an hour-long series described as darkly hued and magical. I love seeing books adapted into other media, especially when there's like 1,000 remakes on everyone's plate. You know, I really like the more original adaptations. But it was really frustrating to me because Deadline and a couple other outlets both call these books young adult and YA like several times in the article, and they're very firmly in middle grade territory. And I don't know if they're doing that because people like know the term YA and a lot of people don't know the term middle grade, but I was just like, that's not what it is. yeah, but I think it's cool. I really love it when the celebrities like get behind some of these books.
There's someone I know, she's actually a Pitch Wars mentor, Kathleen Barber. She has, her book was originally called Are You Sleeping? And it was bought by Reese Witherspoon and made into an Apple show with Octavia Spencer. And it's called Truth Be Told. I think it comes out soon, but that's really cool. Cause we came out the same debut year. And so we were in the same debut group. And so kind of seeing that process, her telling us about it was kind of cool to see how it's kind of all evolved. So.
Yeah.
I read the book, love the book. I'm excited to see how they take that book and make it into a whole series. So.
Sorry, you probably hear my dog walking by. It's like the only sound that my mic picks up other than my voice.
So funny.
Yeah. So usually he's just sleeps through the whole thing. I think that is all the news we have for today. So we're going to go ahead and bring on our special guest. Amanda Nelson is the executive editor of Book Riot, the largest independent editorial book site in North America, and the co-host of the Get Booked podcast. She's appeared on CNN International and NPR's On Point. She says, tell her about your favorite book. And just full disclosure, I also write for Book Riot. I'm a contributor for Book Riot. Welcome, Amanda.
Hi, Amanda.
All right. Am I still muted?
Yeah, I got you.
Thank you. Hello.
Welcome. Heather says, hi, doggo. Yeah. I'm surprised my cat hasn't made an appearance. All right. So, Amanda, welcome to the show. Can you tell us a little bit about what Book Riot is and what you do there?
Sure. So as I very braggily say in my bio, we're the largest independent editorial book site, which means we are a site that covers books and reading and all things having to do with literature, in an editorial fashion. So it's not, you know, a sales site. And we're independent, meaning we're not owned by a larger newspaper or anything. We're not owned by anything, actually. Yeah, we have several, I think at this point we have 11 podcasts. We have, dozens of newsletters, a YouTube channel, we're on every social media platform. And of course, we have content that goes up on the site, bookriot.com every day, where we try to cover something from every genre every day so that there's something for every reader to find on the site every day. And that's what we are about. We've been around for about 8 years. I started as one of the original contributors. There were 10 of us. Now there are 215, I think, full-time staff scattered across the world. And as the executive editor now, I am in charge of overseeing our editorial strategy. I manage the editorial staff. I'm also in charge of, like, if you think of like an old school newspaper circulation editor, that would be kind of very similar to my job. So I'm in charge of growing every aspect of the company. So traffic, podcast downloads, newsletter signups, all of that, social media platforms, all of that is my responsibility. So that's what I do.
Very, very cool. How long has Book Riot been around?
8 years. 9 years?
Oh, that's crazy. Years, yeah. That's amazing that it grew so quickly.
Yeah.
So that's really cool. So I noticed, I read your bio and it lists that you have a background as an indie bookseller. Mm-hmm. And so my first editor at Midnight Ink Alone was an indie bookseller as well. I know a lot of other indie booksellers who transitioned to editing. So I was wondering, like, why do you think that that's such a great jumping off point for other careers in publishing? And I'm also curious to see what made you decide to make that jump from being a bookseller to an editor or a book writer.
Well, I started bookselling because I had twin infants in my house, my twin boys, and I was a stay-at-home mom for about 8 weeks before I lost my mind and like just could not handle it anymore. So I had a book blog at the time and, you know, have always loved reading and stuff. So I went to my favorite local indie and asked if she would hire me so I could get out of my house a little bit. And so that's when I started writing for Book Riot also. And then eventually when I left, Fountain is the bookstore that I worked at. When I left Fountain, it was because Book Riot offered me a full-time position. So working at a bookstore is such a great transition job because you touch every part of a book. Like you have experience with authors, you have experience with events, right. You know how to market, you know how to do publicity. Most booksellers are, you know, they're great at social media, they know how to serve communities, and they know what readers want. Like they're on the front lines of talking to people who love books every day. So it's really easy, I think, to take all of those skills and put them really anywhere in publishing and find use out of them.
That sounds great.
Yeah. Hey, Alex.
Yeah, Alex. So hi, Amanda. So what I just wanted to ask, like, what does a typical work day look like for you? You work from home primarily, right?
Yeah, most of our staff does. We do have offices in Brooklyn where our graphic designer and our developer work. And we have an office in Portland where our managing editor, Sharifa Williams, works, and our CEO, Jeff. And then a couple of other, our associate editor, Vanessa, also works in that office. But most of us work from home. We don't require people to go into the office if they don't want to. But a lot of us have noisy kids and pets, so it's an option. So a typical day for me, they're also different. It usually involves a bunch of conference calls. Since I manage staff now, and I'm not responsible for as much as the content that goes up on the site every day or moderating social media, which is what my job was before I got into this position. It's a lot of conference calls and like strategy calls, podcast recordings. I do a lot. I manage all of our marketing and internal marketing campaigns. So if we're talking about growing a podcast or, we're launching a new product or TBR or insiders program or anything like that, then it's my job to manage all of those campaigns. And then also, run the numbers. I spend a lot of time in Google Analytics, which is like not interesting. it's not fun really, but it's very nerdy and spreadsheety. And if you like stats or data, which I do.
Sarah.
Yeah. And that's appealing, I guess. But it's a lot of like running reports and doing A/B tests on subject lines and stuff like that. And ultimately, it's kind of strange because a lot of my day is that kind of number crunching. And then also a lot of my day is stepping back from that and talking to the rest of our editorial staff about what our readers want. So it's not just like coming up with something people will like, but coming up with stuff that people will find useful and making sure that our readers all hear about it. And then the editorial strategy stuff is mostly about working with staff to do that, to find out like what trends are, we're seeing and what our readers are asking for, which is how we started making podcasts in the first place, because they were like, excuse me, it's like, it's 2011, where's your podcast? I was like, well, I guess we should try that. And like listening to their feedback to craft this overall big editorial strategy for what is like essentially, it's a big company. And so it takes a lot of my day figuring out what we're going to do next.
Wow, that's a lot.
It is a lot.
I didn't know you did that much. Yeah. I'm like, oh, she's just in the Slack telling us what we should write.
I am in the Slack. Yeah, I'm trying to transition a little bit out of the Slack. We have two Slacks. We have a staff Slack, and our contributors all have a Slack as well. And I'm trying to like give more of that responsibility of like direct editorial feedback to our managing editor and less on me. Because our managing editor, Sharifa, is the one who schedules the content every day. She's like, she knows exactly what's going up on the site and she reads the feedback from people on social media. I'm not doing that anymore. So it's really, she's a much more helpful resource at this point. But yeah, the Slack is fun also. Like it's a lot of jokes and memes and GIFs and like Liberty making puns, which is the best. So I do spend a lot of time there. Yeah.
Arguments over long dashes.
Yes. Semicolons.
Kendra said, here for spreadsheets. Yes. I love my spreadsheets. Kelly knows. Mm-hmm. I'm like, so I made a spreadsheet.
Yep.
At one point, she's like, I made five spreadsheets today. I was like, I believe you.
They all have nice, like, color-coded tabs.
They do, yeah. And, like, the programming that, like, turns things different colors when we need to do different things. Yeah. I'm an engineer by training, by education, so I'm all about Excel. Mm-hmm. Jennifer said Slack. So Slack is just, like, a communication, like, platform that a lot of organizations use. It's basically like a big organized chat room.
Yeah. It's like a desktop app. Yeah. You can have it on your phone also, but I don't recommend anyone do that.
So for the Get Booked podcast, you give recommendations to people with often very specific, but also somehow vague requests, right?
Yeah.
How do you find the books to recommend for all of these?
Well, my co-host and I are both former independent booksellers. Jen Northington is my co-host, and she worked at Word in Brooklyn for years and was their event manager. And anyone who's worked at a bookstore, you know, like, you develop this kind of magical skill to maintain an encyclopedic knowledge of everything you've ever read. So I don't know. It's like this weird, almost keyword recall that I have in my head, where if somebody asks for, you know, I want a mermaid horror novel, I can rifle through my brain to, like, think of what that would be. Because that's like what most of a bookseller's job is finding these really specific, and, like, librarians, of course, do this all day also, like, finding these really specific things that people are looking for. Or also, like you said, like, super vague, like, I want a good story about a dog. Like, okay, well, let me go through every book I've ever read in my brain that involves dogs. I also have a secret Goodreads account that I, like, don't, you know, I don't use it for social networking at all, but I have started using it for the shelving. So, like, I can make keywords mostly for locations. Smart. Yeah. Cause, like, people ask us for recommendations a lot for when they're traveling. Like, I'm going to Venezuela. What should I read about Venezuela to learn about it before I go? And so I can go to my Goodreads account and see what I've read that's come from Venezuela. So I use it for, location and genre. A lot. If I can't think of anything, I ask the contributors. Like, I go to our Slack and I'm like, hey, y'all, I have somebody on Get Booked who's asking for, like, you know, lesbian romance set in space, also Victorian. Like, help me, you know? And then with their 200 brains combined, they usually give me enough suggestions that I can go and get them from the library or, like, buy them real quick and read them before recording so I can talk about them on the show. Yeah.
Yeah. That's
pretty cool.
I've asked that Slack for recommendations even, and I don't have a podcast, that sometimes I just need a recommendation.
Yeah. Like, I just want to read this.
A good book, right? So I work for a media company, and podcasting is actually really huge for us right now. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious to see where you see publishing going in terms of covering books. Like, do you think, like, the relatively newer elements, like, you know, Bookstagram and BookTube and podcasts are going to become even more popular, or that, like, things like reviews and newsletters are always going to still have, like, a big place in what people find to read?
I don't know about reviews. We've actually never really done, like, straight traditional book reviewing on Book Riot. And one of the reasons why we started the site is because book reviews are kind of boring. Like, they're useful, you know, and they're useful, especially in industry ways. But most readers don't read reviews in traditional media. So we've never really done them. Newsletters, I don't think, are ever going to go away. Newsletters are actually one of our fastest growing, and have always been for the past almost decade, one of our fastest growing platforms. Because, you know, you can, they're just easy. Like, it's just mail. Yeah. Like, they're so easy and people like them. And it's weird that they're coming back, that they're becoming so popular, but now, like, tiny letter is a thing and personalized newsletters are a thing. But I do think, podcasts and BookTube and Bookstagram are definitely, in the same way that book blogs did, like, 10 years ago, disrupting the kind of book media space. These are the people are coming off of making, you know, their blogspot.com or even their Tumblrs, or, like, any of those kinds of static blogs where they talk about books, and moving to these more multimedia places to talk about books. And you can see publishers are doing it too. Like, publishers have started launching their own podcasts where they interview their authors, and, you know, Novel Suspects, I think, has one.
Oh, yeah.
Did I make that up? No.
They might.
Yeah, I think they've got one. Penguin Tea. I don't remember. Anyway, there were a couple. I've like, there have been several in the past few weeks that have been like, oh, this sounds like a cool podcast. And then I look into it and I realize, oh, this is from a publisher. Like, they're getting on the bandwagon. So we'll see how that goes for that. I'm really interested actually in how a publisher run podcast would perform, because most readers don't know one publisher from another. They don't recognize imprints, and why should they? Like, it doesn't matter. But so are they going to like seek out, I don't know, an Avon podcast? I don't know. Yeah. We'll see.
I think they would probably like hear that an author that they like is on it. And then
yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Jennifer said, Kelly.
I was just going to say something totally random.
Jennifer said, Penguin is at an urban fantasy podcast for many years.
Oh, cool.
Oh, wonder how popular it is.
Mm-hmm. They're never going to tell us, but I would love to know.
Yeah. What were you going to say, Kelly?
I was going to say, I know how, like, I think, is it Macmillan? They have the Criminal Element newsletter, which is their mystery newsletter, but they do cover other, you know, other imprints and other publishers as well. So I'm curious if these podcasts that they have are going to just focus. Obviously the like St. Martin's books are going to be first and foremost, and Minotaur books are first and foremost on Criminal Element, but they cover other books as well. So I wonder if it'll be the same thing with these podcasts, that they'll be talking about their books the most and first, but they'll also cover other books as well, which I hope they would do. So
yeah. I know Publishers Weekly has a podcast now because I see it in the newsletter. And Barnes & Noble Teen has a podcast.
Podcasts are, like, at my job, we'd have, like, 5 or 6 new podcasts a week. Like, we have a lot of podcasts.
All right. So we have a lot of authors who watch the show. So for authors who are trying to get the kind of coverage that Book Riot provides, what can they do to increase their chances of getting mentioned or talked about?
I would say contacting the people who are doing that kind of coverage personally. So like if you are on the site and you write mysteries and thrillers and you want to pitch the mystery thriller, our mystery thriller newsletter author, or the host of our mystery thriller podcast, which is called Red or Dead, then you can, they have email addresses that they drop at the top of every show. Or you can just reply back to the newsletter if you're trying to get in contact with the newsletter writer, and that will go straight to them. So going like through the general email, like we have a pitch email, it's called bookriot@bookriot.com. You can certainly send things there, and we have a staff person who opens all of those emails and sends them to the person they think would be most interested in the pitch. But getting to the people who are doing that specific coverage is like way more efficient than having to go through like 3 different levels of staff before your email finally makes it to the right person. But I would just go onto the site and find out which podcasts and which newsletters are most relevant to the book that you've written, and then just email those people. Or most of them have their Twitter handles also in like their bio pages on the site. So you can just talk to them on Twitter also. Yeah. But go like straight to the contributor. Skip.
So what should they not do?
DM me on Instagram. What should they not do? Spamming, like the more general your hose is, I guess, of contact, the least likely you are to get to the right person at Book Riot, because we have 200 writers, we have 15 staff people. The likelihood of you like hitting the right person is very slim if you like tweet at us. You know, we don't take book pitches on Twitter. If you post stuff to our Facebook wall, it just gets deleted. Like nobody's going to read that. Emailing our general inbox is fine, and you can do that. But you know, we get hundreds of those emails every day, so we are paying attention to those. But it's not nearly as effective as talking to like a specific person who you know covers your stuff. So I just don't be spammy, I guess, is what I'm saying. And that's true for anything. Like if you're trying to get a bookstagrammer to cover your books, you're trying to get somebody on YouTube to cover your books, it's the same sort of thing. Make sure that your content is actually relevant to the person you're talking to. And then write a personal email about why they would be interested in your book instead of like a, you know, form pitch. Because people can tell when you actually have put in an effort. So don't do that.
Yeah, as a contributor, I often get emails. They're like, oh, I really, you know, like your coverage on Book Riot. I would like to offer you a copy of my book in exchange for a review.
No, yeah,
and
we don't do
Book
that.
Already doesn't do reviews. And so I'm like, oh, how much of my content did you actually read?
Right. Yeah, and we also don't do, we don't promise coverage in exchange for review copies. We take review copies for coverage consideration because it's always possible that, you know, a contributor can take a review copy, write up an article about a book that they've read, and then our editorial team can be like, actually, this isn't a good fit for the site, you know, and then the piece gets killed. So we don't like to promise coverage in that way. So yeah, I like the, I'll send you a book in exchange for a thing is no, we don't do in exchange.
Yeah. And I've also never really written an article about a single book. I did once. It was Blood, Water, Paint by Joy McCullough. I did
that's
like
a good one.
Well, I mean, that's why, you know? Yeah. And yeah, so it's usually like I'm doing like lists or like something themed, you know?
Yeah. And that's where I say to talk to the podcast folks and the newsletter folks more specifically, because they, like a lot of the newsletter writers will cover, like here are the new releases in romance this week, you know, when Jess Pryde is writing Kissing Books, which is our newsletter for romance readers. So they talk more about specific titles in the podcast and in the newsletters than we do on the site. The site content is much more general and listy, like you said, or like in-depth investigations of stuff. Like it's not traditional one-off book reviews.
Yeah, I did receive a pitch one time and I thought it was really great. It was an author and they said, we want to do, I can't remember exactly, but it was like middle grade writers about what fairy tale world they would like to live in.
Ooh. Right?
Yeah. And she had like authors lined up. And I like, she had diverse authors lined up. So obviously she's paying attention. Right. And so it was like very easy for me then to like put that all together and make it into an article. So I always, when I talk about like book publicity all the time, I'm like, always do like something value add, like let, you know, not just be like, hey, read my book, you know, but if you can do something a little bit extra that people would be interested in.
Yeah.
So my question's kind of similar. It's actually just for debut authors. So I think, you know, having been a debut author a couple of years ago, knowing a lot of debut authors, the scariest thing is promotion, you know, how to promote your book. You know, so what do you wish like every debut author would do? And then what is the common mistake you see a lot of debut authors doing?
It's actually pretty similar to to normal. Yeah, I see a lot of debut authors doing, I think they get understandably a little like panicky about how they don't maybe have as much marketing or publicity support from their publishers as they thought they would, which most debut authors don't have, whatever, that's like a whole separate rant. But they don't, they're right. Like the panic is justified. And so they start doing the spammy thing of like posting on our Facebook wall or like getting into our Instagram DMs and stuff like that because they like really want to get in front of a person. Which is right, but those are just the wrong ways. So I would love a debut author to, like I said, like find the person who you think is going to be most interested in what you're writing and just reach out to that one person. And it's easy. Like we get so many pitches. I think condensing your book, this sounds terrible, but like condensing your book down to like a line, you know, which is something that I know a lot of authors don't really want to do because like your book is your baby and you spent so much time on this thing and you want to write like a whole essay about how amazing it is. But people get so much in their inboxes that like if you can make it snappy and attention grabbing and why it appeals to you. You know, like when I get pitches for feminist retellings of classics, I'm like, yes, that's all I need. I don't even care which one it is. Like just that line is enough for me. And then I got a debut, I asked actually for a debut novel. It's called Anna Kay. It's a feminist modern retelling of Anna Karenina with an Asian main character. And like, I am all over that. And when I got the pitch, I was like, yeah, send that to me. And it was personalized. Like the pitch was personalized and they knew my content and they knew what kind of stuff I like to read. So yeah, I totally get the need to get your book in front of as many people as possible when you don't feel like you're getting as much support as you should, but be specific, like narrow your focus and be specific with who you're trying to reach out to.
I don't think I have a friend who was telling me how like someone keeps sending him messages and it's like just general, it's so clear that they just copy and pasted it from several people. And it's like, we can tell. Like, yeah. Like, we can tell when you didn't do the research, you just are hitting a bunch of people. We can tell. So, like, yeah. Put the effort in. So,
yeah, like, we'll get pitches sometimes from people who forget booked, who want to, you know, I have debut authors who want to come on the show to talk about their books. We've never had an author on the show ever. Okay. Like, that's just not the format. So, obviously, you've never listened to it.
Yeah.
So, I'm just not going to, whatever. So, don't do that. Like, don't make it obvious like, that you don't know what you're asking me for.
Yeah. So Amanda, you've been an outspoken advocate for diversity in publishing, especially encouraging readers and tastemakers to think critically about what books they're picking up and why. And I know you actually had like a pretty big impact on the way I choose books personally. but can you talk a little bit about the evolution of your efforts over the years?
Yeah, the more power I got at work, the more my efforts evolved, mostly. But so when I started writing about books online, I had a book blog about classic literature, and it was called Dead White Guys. And so that was a very like controversial title, but I thought it was funny. I was just trying to be funny, like whatever. Don't be so sensitive. And so internet, Twitter. But I, from the jump, was trying to make that a conversation because I think, you know, when I started writing about books online 10 years ago, traditional publishing or traditional book media was still very powerful and very white towery. And it was, you know, a lot of very educated and distinguished white men writing about other really educated and distinguished white men, which is fine. Like, it doesn't mean their books are bad. They're just not books that I care about because they're not anything that reflects my experience or how I live in the world. And so when I got the platform that I got at Book Riot, and we realized when the site started that it was going to be something, like that it was successful, I realized that I have access to all of these readers and I can talk to them about their reading choices. Because I don't want to blame readers for like, why do you read only white people or why do you only read men? Because people just like read what they want, right? They're just like going after the books that they're familiar with or that reflect their reality or whatever. But our tastes don't exist in a vacuum as readers. Like, we aren't born fully formed wanting to read whatever, historical Regency romance or cozy mysteries or whatever. Like, our tastes are formed over time, and we can't escape the influence of marketing, and the books that get the most marketing money behind them are usually really established white male authors. So like, when you say, I just want to pick up a good book, I don't pay attention to, you know, the race or the gender or the sexuality or anything of the author. What you're really saying is, I'm just want to pick up the book that I've heard about the most, or that's been the most marketed to me, or that has the cover that's been tested over and over again until it appeals to me, the person with the book buying dollars. So I don't need people to make like spreadsheets like I do with my reading life, because this is my job. But if people would just pay attention to, if you only ever read books by white authors, just why? Like, why? You know, like, examine your reading life a little bit, maybe pay attention to the last 10 or 15 books you picked up and see if you can notice any patterns. And so as Book Riot got bigger and bigger, we started being more vocal about it at publishing, because we think that that's like the real issue. It's not necessarily readers. It's that publishing isn't putting out books that people want to be reading. Publishing is 80% white, over 80% white, and most of the powerful positions in publishing are held by men, even though the publishing industry is overwhelmingly female. Most of the big management positions are dudes. So that, and you know, people publish the books that reflect their reality. Like, publishers, people who work in publishing aren't exempt from the same sorts of bias and choices that the rest of us are making. So we pointed our very loud and snarky and gift-filled criticism at publishers, and also like BEA. Like, the first year Book Riot existed, BEA had more cats as featured authors than authors of color. Like, Grumpy Cat had a main stage. No authors of color had a main stage, not a single one. And so we made a big fuss about that, and then that's never been a problem. Not that like we fixed it, but we made a big fuss about it, you know. And I know that they became more aware of this stuff, who they were main staging at BEA after that. And then myself personally, I've written a lot of content for the site about reading diversely, making sure you're reading diversely. When publishing does it wrong, I have no problem with writing posts about that. And then when I got into management and when I became the managing editor, I made it an editorial policy that we had to cover a certain percentage of authors of color on every aspect of our site. So when we write a list, you need to be at least 30% of that list needs to be authors of color. When all of our podcasts, our coverage is the same, the newsletter coverage is the same, even like down to our daily deals, we don't put out daily deal emails that are only white authors, which sometimes means the emails go out 2 hours later than they should have because we have to dig a little harder, but that's just how it is. So it's been very intentional that since we have all of this power, it's so weird to say, but since we have this huge platform and we have, you know, an audience of almost 3 million people, we want to do something useful with that and have people think a little bit more about what they're reading and make sure that we are using it responsibly. That was a lot.
That's great. You know, I'm in crime fiction, which is very slowly kind of behind YA mm-hmm. when it comes to kind of focusing on diversity, you know, and we've kind of had some road bumps the last year or so. So it's been pretty interesting. So
I remember when I was doing a YouTube video for our channel when it first launched, and I wanted to do cozy mysteries with like funny titles because the punny titles in cozy mysteries are amazing. Like they're so great. And I emailed a publisher and I said, you know, please send me any punny cozy mysteries that you have by authors of color. And the email I got back was, we don't have any. We just don't have any. That's not something we pay attention to in our acquisitions. I was like, okay. I bet you're going to now that I've emailed you. mystery romance also has a lot of really public dust ups about diversity, especially in their awards.
We'll have, my friend and I were talking, Alexia Gordon, who's, I think she was probably one of the first cozy mysteries in the last probably like 5 years. Mm-hmm. She came out 2016 and people say to her, like, why don't more people of color, more black people write cozy mysteries? And we're like, we write them, they don't get published, you know, because my book took over a year to sell. And it's not a cozy, but it's a traditional mystery and a funny mystery. And it's like, all of a sudden now it's like it won all these awards and everyone's like, oh, it's so great and I want more books like this. But I'm like, it was the same exact book. Like the book that won the awards is pretty much the same exact book that didn't sell. Like, you know, so it's kind of funny to me that now you want them when you didn't want them before it was trendy and people were caring about it. So
Yeah. Well, I think it's all wrapped up in like how traditional book media has been a little bit dismantled, you know, like book sections and newspapers are going away. And I'm not saying that that's a good thing, but the space being made for people who aren't really distinguished white men to have big platforms and to talk about the books that they want to be reading has put a lot of pressure on publishers to shift this. And these are huge, like these are multi-billion dollar multinational corporations. Steering them in a new direction is like moving the frickin' Titanic. And so it's taken, you know, all 8 years of Book Riot's existence for us to see. And it's not, you know, obviously it's not us, but like for the entire time I've been in this job, they've been slowly adjusting and we're going in the right direction, but it's still a problem.
Yeah. I think I've seen, cause we have a crime writers of color group now and we've had, I think more big five purchases of writers of color in the last year, I want to say, than I think in the last previous 10 years or even like 15 years, you know, but as I kind of always say, and like, my fear is that it's going to be considered a trend, and I kind of don't want it to be a trend. I want it to be the status quo, you know? So as excited as I am that Big Five and publishers are finally kind of embracing again, because it wasn't in the 90s they embraced it, I want to make sure it's something that is continuing to happen and not just because it's hot right now.
So, right. Yeah, same.
Yeah. All right. Well, Heather thought that your Dead White Men title
was hysterical. It's hysterical.
Thank you. It was funny. Not everyone thought it was funny.
It's funny. Whatever. So my next question is talking about kind of social media. And so you guys have like a big social media presence, you know, like 200,000 followers plus on Instagram and Twitter, 800,000 on Facebook. So can you talk about the role that social media plays for you guys at Book Riot, especially kind of your Instagram, which is more kind of curated content than just, you know, boosting your articles. So,
yeah. So Instagram is terrible for directing people to like articles.
Yeah. They don't let you like click on link. Yeah. It's like,
it's purposefully, they make it purposely difficult because they want you to stay in the ecosystem. Instagram we use, for like funny memes to just, engage with our readers in a really like positive way that isn't as necessarily confrontational as Facebook and Twitter can sometimes be, or adversarial maybe even. So we try to make our Instagram, we have a new Instagram account for just YA, that's Book Riot YA, and both of them are the same, where we're sharing like quotes that are relevant to whatever's happening right now, pictures of books that we just like. It's very personal, like just something that staff has really enjoyed. We'll put up a picture of it. We do like giveaways and things like that. But social media was so important to us when we first started. It was back before when we started Book Riot, Facebook hadn't put in any of their algorithms. So everything that we put up, our audience saw. And so it was a huge traffic driver for us in the beginning. And we saw so much growth on Facebook and on the site because of Facebook. Obviously that stopped when Facebook instituted their algorithms. Every time Facebook has changed their algorithm, our traffic from Facebook has decreased substantially. So now it's a very small, I think most of our traffic is 13% from social media. And, you know, that's all social media, not just Facebook. But it was very important to us when we started. Twitter has been interesting. Twitter is an interesting beast. We don't grow, obviously we have a big following on Twitter. We don't grow as quickly there as we do in other social media networks. And Twitter can be very stressful to moderate because, I mean, it's stressful for everybody, right? Like who honestly loves being on Twitter? I don't know anyone. But we have had, it got stressful enough that we had to split our social media moderation amongst the editorial staff. So now it's four different people moderate our comments and moderate our content across social, because mostly Twitter and Facebook can be so much, like it can be so conflict driven, and you know, all the, you know, hot takes that people have about social right now, there, a lot of them are true. It can be really hard to spend 8 hours a day getting yelled at. So especially when we first started, and we were certainly not the first, but one of the bigger book media companies that was really openly political and like had a very obvious editorial direction that involved politics and talking about politics and being political. And that doing that on Twitter, especially when you're a company where the face is a woman of color, was a lot. Like, I don't know that Twitter... excuse me. You know, it was a lot. It's been super important for us. We wouldn't be where we are if it hadn't been for Facebook's growth in the beginning. But most of our readers don't come from social media anymore, but we are still very dedicated to providing like a fun environment for our readers who are following us on all social media platforms. Yeah.
So as a follow-up, this question actually for both of you guys, I want to kind of talk about, so Amanda, I've been on your Instagram, I was like totally stalking you, and it's very simple. I like how it's just really like just pictures of books you're reading and kind of your detailed caption with your thoughts. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just kind of curious. So for me, I'm always struggling with the different platforms to say how much of it is going to be personal and how much of it is book stuff, because I don't want it to be so much book stuff for people who are my friends who are not there for book stuff to be like, okay, Kelly's posting about her book again. But also I want people who are there for books to also be. So like for both of you guys, how do you guys find that balance of personal and professional? Sarah.
You want to go first?
For Instagram, I honestly don't worry about it. Like I'm strategic on Twitter and Facebook, but on Instagram, I don't even care. Which is why, like, if you go to my Instagram, you're going to see pictures of food and pictures of my cat, like
personal, yeah,
and pictures of my dog. And like, but also those are the posts that get the most engagement. Yeah. So even if I do post about books or whatever, the food posts get way more because I cook a lot because I have like some food allergies that make it hard for me to eat out. And so I cook a lot and I put pictures and people love it. And I don't know why. And then sometimes, like if I'm at an event or if I'm like hanging out with someone cool or something, you know, I'll put like a group picture or something on there. Instagram, I just don't really, which is weird because I feel like a lot of people are like, oh, Instagram's the biggest like growth market right now. But I don't worry about it too much. Mm-hmm. I don't stress out over Instagram.
Instagram is, it is true for us, it's usually the fastest growing like week to week. Our Instagram accounts are, but what do you do with that? Like, if you can't send people to your content and it's like, there's no buy links unless you are already in that program. So like you're growing, but like for what, you know, to be entertaining and to have fun is what we've landed on for now until it becomes more obvious how it can be useful to us. But like the growth of Instagram shouldn't stop you from like doing whatever you want to do with it, I guess. So for me, I'm not on Facebook or Twitter. So I don't have any advice there, but my Instagram account, my grid is mostly just pictures of a book, again, on my dining room table. My personal stuff I put in my stories. So like today I went to a winery and there's a bunch of pictures of me being bougie at a winery in my stories. But if you want to know how I felt about Miracle Creek, it's in, you know, it's in my grid.
Angie Kim.
Yes, it's so good. It's so good and like traumatizing and such a tough read, but I loved it so much. And for me, like other than Get Booked, I don't have, since I'm not in the editorial content creation anymore at work, I don't have a place really to talk about just like what I read this week. So I decided, and Get Booked is like people ask me for very specific things. So it's not just going to be whatever it is that I picked up. But I do have I don't know how many followers I have, but like enough that I feel some responsibility to use the platform to talk about authors who I want to direct attention to. So I don't want to give that up just to like put up pictures of my dog. So that's where I decided to like put the dog in the stories and keep the grid about books, because I do want to use the platform responsibly, I guess.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. We have our final question for you. I do want to mention, like, I've been struggling lately because I'm judging for the Audi. So I'm like, all my reading time is going to that. And so I can't talk about any of the books I'm reading.
Yeah, Kelly too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's something. But yeah, so like we have this weekly thread in the Pitch Wars group that's like, what are you reading this week? I'm like, I still can't talk about it. And because usually I'm in there every week, like, this is what I'm reading, this is what's next, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's rough. I can't wait to pick my own books again.
Yeah.
All right. So our final question is, what is the most important book you've ever read?
Look, y'all warned me that this question was coming and I thought
this is a Sarah question. This is not a Kelly question.
It's so hard. Okay. I think I have an answer. So I think my answer is East of Eden by John Steinbeck. And the reason is when I grew up in a very conservative evangelical household, and I took a lot of that, all of that with me, because I didn't know any better, with me when I went to college. I read a lot of Ayn Rand in college. Like, I have an Ayn Rand tattoo. It's a mood. It's terrible. Whatever. Like, she's awful. She's awful. But I was 18. Like, every 18-year-old has, like, a dumb libertarian phase. And I read all of that Ayn Rand and was such a jerk about it. And then I read East of Eden, and it completely, like, gave me back my heart. And that's the thing about Ayn Rand that I think is, like, she's so rhetorically talented that she can capture you in this, like, really heartless, cold idea of how the world should work that's influenced our world in so many terrible ways. And then when I read East of Eden, it really reminded me of the value of compassion and, like, the value of structural compassion, because so much of East of Eden is about, like, government stepping in to save people from starving, you know? And when I was an Ayn Rand head, I was like, I don't understand why that's important, you know? And then I read East of Eden and was like, all right, okay. Because humans are cool. Like, it gave me back a lot of my humanity that I had given up based on what I had read before that. So I think East of Eden is probably the most important book that I've ever read. I wouldn't say it's my favorite, but definitely changed my life.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a good answer.
Thank you. Took me a while.
You had a little time to prepare. Not much, so. All right, Amanda, can you let the viewers know where they can find you? I guess on Instagram would probably be.
My Instagram handle is I'm Amanda Nelson, and then Get Booked is my show. So yeah. You can email me if you want. It's Amanda at riotnewmedia.com. Yeah.
Cool. Thank you, Amanda, for joining us. And
thank you.
Thank you for having me.
You too. Bye, Amanda.
Bye.
All right, so we have just a couple things to do before we close out the show. Audio of the book of the week was a feature that I wanted to include on this show because I just love audiobooks a lot. And so it's like purely, selfish. But the audiobook for this week is one I read a couple weeks ago. I think like in August, I read it in August. It's The Warehouse by Rob Hart. The publisher says, quote, set in the confines of a corporate panopticon that's at once brilliantly imagined and terrifyingly real, The Warehouse is a near future thriller about what happens when Big Brother meets big business and who will pay the ultimate price. NPR called it a fun, fast-paced read that walks a fine line between a near-future thriller and smart satire. Makes you wonder if we're already too far into a disastrous future or if there's still some hope for humanity. And it's narrated primarily by Emily Wu Zeller, who's like one of my very favorite audiobook narrators. And this was actually sent to me by the publisher, and Rob Hart was a Pitch Wars mentor. And so that's what caught my eye at first. And then when I saw Emily Wu Zeller narrated it, I was like, yes.
Sold.
Yeah, I'll listen to pretty much anything she narrates. But part of it is read by Jason Culp. So there's a character in it who is like the CEO of the company. That's kind of the, I want to say it's an Amazon analog. And he is just like this really Southern gentleman with like, you know, the kind of homey, like hokey personality. But he's also like terribly evil. And the actor just did like a fantastic job reading him. Like, cause he just sounds like, you know, your grandfather from Arkansas, but also he's like a terrible human. So, yeah. So I just love the audiobook. Did you read this book, Kelly?
I haven't read it yet, but I made Rob give me a copy of it. So I need to read it. So don't hate me, Rob. I love you.
No spoilers.
But he'll be at BoucherCon this week, which is cool.
Everyone's going to be at BoucherCon except for
all the cool people will be at BoucherCon. BoucherCon is the largest mystery conference in the world, I think they call themselves. And so it's going to be in Dallas this week, end of week, Thursday through Sunday. So, and Alex is going to be there, Sagara is going to be there. I'll be there. A bunch of Pitch Wars people like Lane Fargo, Kristen LaBianca, Kathleen Barber, Elizabeth Little. So it's going to be like a little Pitch Wars reunion.
And I was there last year, but I won't.
Yeah, we had so much fun. Yeah. We had so much fun. You'll be missed.
Kendra said, yes, I love her narration. She's really great. Emily Wu Zeller, my favorite. Ebony said, just added The Warehouse to my whole list. Yeah, awesome. All right, so it's time to discuss the viewer poll. And I always have to take a second to like figure out how to share this because it's always confusing to me. But I think I have it on my Twitter and we're going to play it out. It ended at 9:30. So it's the question was, where do you most often find out about books you'd like to read? Social media, friends, colleagues, library, bookstore, browse, or blogs/magazines/newspapers. But I feel like after I posted this, I was like, you know, I'm posting this on social media, so of course people are going to say social media. And it looks like that's 60% social media, 19% friends, colleagues, 17% library, bookstore, browse, and just 3% blogs, magazines, and newspaper.
That's interesting.
I posted on Twitter, so... You know, people are going to say social media, of course. And then some people, I knew this would happen, would say, I find out about it from my friends on social media, so they don't know which answer to do.
But when I was obviously back in the day, in my younger days, I used to go to Barnes & Noble and just like walk around and just look at all the books. And I haven't done that in a very, very, very long time.
Oh, so. I still do it.
I should go to a bookstore. I should go to an independent bookstore one day and just look around.
Yeah, it's fun. But I do, most of the books I find out about for me is on social media, like people talking about them. Or often, like, because I get audiobook e-arcs from publishers. And so a lot of it's at like the publisher pitch emails, but that's just because I write for Book Riot, you know? So that was.
I'm actually on NetGalley, but I don't request books because I don't want to review them anywhere. I'm too lazy.
Yeah.
So I will literally go on NetGalley and I will look at like the upcoming crime fiction and then I'll be like, okay, I should either buy this or I might go to my library and like reserve it so when it comes out I can be one of the first people to do it.
I'm also on NetGalley, but I can't figure out, which is weird for me because usually I'm pretty good with technology, but I can't figure out. So like my old phone is listed as like my Amazon, whatever, mm-hmm. my where the eBooks will go from Amazon for my Kindle account. And I can't figure out how to switch it to my new phone.
So you can you do it on Amazon? You can't do it on Amazon?
Maybe. I don't buy any books from Amazon. I think that's why I'm like, I don't know how to do this.
So I know. So I, whenever, cause there's also like that, I just was telling me about this. There's this read now feature that you can go and like, you don't have to like request the book. It's just available. And then, you can like click on like Kindle and it just will go to whatever I have listed as my Kindle email address, but I have to change it in Amazon. So
yeah, that's what it is. Yeah.
So maybe check on Amazon.
The destination for my Amazon, my Kindle email
address. Yeah, check on Amazon and you should go under Kindle. You'll be able to change your email address.
Yeah.
So also, please note that I'm helping Sarah out with technology. Hope everyone's watching this on video. So
yeah, this is not usual.
Not at all. Thank you, Ebony. Ebony's congratulated me.
Yeah, your book's on joining the audio world. You gotta let us know who the actress is whenever they choose her. Cause
my agent like approached me. And she's like, "You got an offer for audio," and I was so surprised because my first book came out 2 years ago. My second book came out a year ago, and so we ended up getting two offers, and we took one. And one of the things we're able to talk about is I want to kind of have input. So I wanted to make sure it's a Black actress who's doing the voice. Mm-hmm. And so like my mother and my brother and I like spent a whole afternoon just like listening to a bunch of Black voice actors and my mother is so funny. She's like now an expert. She's so-called expert on audio. And she's like, she sounds too old. She wouldn't be. And I'm like, Mom, you literally just started listening to audiobook narration like 10 minutes ago. But now you're this expert on like the best voice for my character. It's so funny.
Yeah. And they can like the good ones. They do a really good job of like aging their voice up or down.
That's what I figured, you know, because my character is like probably like 26, 27, Black woman. She's from the South, so and also for me, my book has a lot of humor in it, so I want to make sure that this is a person who can nail the humor correctly too. So yeah.
Emily Wuzeller, we were just talking about. She narrates a lot of young adult and. But then she narrated that. She narrated Helen Hong's second book.
Oh, nice.
And she definitely can age her voice up and down. So
I'm excited to like get the samples and like hear it. So
yeah. All right. I think is that everything? Oh, the quote of the week, which is another fun thing that I just decided to do because I like quotes. I'm like, this is my show. I'm just going to do what I want. So a room without books is like a body without a soul. And like, this is a very commonly shared quote about books. And so you're kind of like, yeah, okay. But then you have to consider like, I'm a minimalist. And so books only belong in one room. Like they have their place and they need to stay there. unless I'm reading one actively. And so like, I don't necessarily agree with this quote. But I would say a house.
I was just thinking that. I'm like, you have to say like a house without books.
Yeah, that's better for me. All right. Yeah. I just love, I'm like, I'm going to choose this quote that I don't agree with.
So I can tell them I don't like it.
All right. So thank you so much, Kelly, for joining me.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. Of course. Thanks for coming. I really love that some of my friends are just like, yeah, I'll do it. And then don't realize what they're signing up for it, but they'll just do it anyway. That's great.
Like we love you.
I was texting the person who's going to be my co-host for the 11/9 show, November 9th show. Erica Cameron is going to be my co-host for that. And I texted her and asked her if she wanted to do it. She's like, yeah. And I said, okay, email me your headshot and your book cover and whatever. And so she did. And she's like, wait, what did I sign up to do?
I said yes, and then I literally watched the one that you did because I wasn't able to watch it live. So I like watched the one you did with Brenda like this week, and I was like, I should probably watch to see what I'm doing.
Just wing it. It's fine.
Right, no, yeah. Sarah, you guys, Sarah gives you a very long, like I think it was like 7-page document of like a script. So it's very well thought out. They're doing a great job with it. So
yeah, it's funny. People are like, I don't know if I could do it. I'm like, you can. Like, I give you a layout, you know, a guide.
Yeah, it's very, very well planned out.
So. All right, so thank you, Kelly. Have a good night. And I'm gonna close this out with a couple different things. And everybody say bye to Kelly. All right, so thank you guys so much for watching. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to tell your friends because that is how a show like this grows. Don't forget to like and subscribe so you don't miss another episode. And we also have, you can subscribe via email to get reminders, day of reminders, every episode. And that link is in the description. And also, if you'd like to support the show on Patreon, the link for that is down below as well. And I do want to rip the audio and turn it into a supplemental podcast. But I don't have the money to pay for the platform. So that's my first goal whenever I get the patrons to support that. And also the social media for both of our guests are in the description down below, as long as well as the Pub Talk Live social media info. So thank you all so much for watching. Have a good night.
Thank you so much for listening to this pre-recorded episode of Pub Talk Live. To find out more about the show and to find out how you can watch live, go to pubtalk.live. Thank you so much to my Patreon podcast sponsors, Brenda Drake and Jay Lynn.